Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Did you know that Americans who live in Washington, D.C. do not have a voting representative in Congress? Now, in 2015, American citizens living in D.C. pay taxes, serve in the military, and fulfill all our duties as citizens, yet do not have anyone who can vote for them in either the U.S. House or the U.S. Senate. If you move to Washington, D.C., you too would lose your representation in Congress. How is this possible? Why don't residents have representation in the House or Senate? And what can be done to bring full rights of citizenship to residents of the nation's capital? Here to talk with us about this denial of the rights of citizenship in our nation's capital and what we can do about it is Daniel Solomon, a founder and current board member of DC Vote, a nonprofit organization dedicated to gaining voting representation in Congress for residents of the District of Columbia. Daniel is also a board member of the University of the District of Columbia School of Law Foundation and a former board member of the Washington Regional Association of Grantmakers. Prior to his work with DC Vote, Daniel worked at the U.S. Department of Labor on international labor rights and child labor violations and has received many awards for his work for democracy and human rights. He is a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley and Northeastern University School of Law. Daniel Solomon, welcome to All Together Now.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. This is a topic that a lot of people don't know about, but it's really important. So to start us off, is it true that people who live in Washington, D.C. do not have anyone representing them in the U.S. House or Senate?
Yeah, no, it's exactly true. And it's astonishing to most Americans. In fact, the polling that's been done, when you ask Americans, you know, are the residents of the district treated equally in terms of representation, even though it's a two-question answer, yes or no, they get it wrong more than half of the time because most people can't conceive of the possibility that people in the district wouldn't have representation. It makes no sense at all.
Yeah, and it was shocking to me as someone, and you know, you take your voting rights for granted. This is what we fought about back in 1776, is no taxation without representation. We wanted the ability to elect the people that would set the rules that govern us. And that's true for American citizens across the country, except for our very own nation's capital.
Yes, that's right. We're an anomaly, a very odd duck indeed.
So American citizens in D.C., we pay taxes, we fight and die for the country, but we don't have anyone representing us in Congress. How did that happen?
Well, it really goes back to the founding of the country. And when the city was created, when Congress was meeting actually in Philadelphia in the 1780s, before the Second Constitutional Convention, there was an incident where people who had served in the Revolutionary War, there were Civil War, Revolutionary War pensioners, weren't getting paid. And the Congress was meeting in Philadelphia, and so some folks got together and they went to the City Hall where the state legislature was meeting. It's also where the Constitutional Congress was meeting. And they surrounded it, and they, you know, yelled and screamed and held up signs. I think a few even pointed a musket at the building, and were demanding their what they thought was their right to pay that they weren't getting. And the founding fathers who were there thought, well, you know, the governor should get rid of these people. They should call out, the governor should call out the state militia and make them go away. But when he looked out at the crowd, he saw not just a rabble, but he saw a lot of his voters, and decided it wouldn't be in his political interest to make them go away. So he didn't call out the militia.
This is very personal at the beginning.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's one thing you always learn in politics, right? It's all about what's good for the politicians. So they thought what would be in their interest in the long run would be to have total control over wherever the seat of government was. It hadn't been chosen yet for Washington, but they recognized that they thought it would make sense for them to have total and exclusive jurisdiction so that they could call out the militia in case, you know, the people got a little too uppity. So that's what they wrote in, and it wasn't until 1800 that the city of Washington was actually created. It was selected as the site for the new government.
So it was written into the Constitution that the nation's capital would be at some basically neutral territory, not belonging to any state and not being a state.
That's exactly right.
So what is the cost of D.C. not having voting rights?
Well, part of the, to jump way to the future, when the city finally got some rights to have some local elections, at that point, there were a few things that we were not allowed to do. We were allowed to, for the first time in 1974 and then going forward, elect our own mayor. It's the first time we'd ever been able to elect our own mayor by the people.
And that was in 1974?
That wasn't until 1974. So we can go through the history if you want later. But
yeah,
going forward from that point, we were not allowed to do a lot of things, such as tax income where it's earned. Now, an enormous, something like 60% of the income that's earned in the district goes to people who actually live in Maryland and Virginia. They come into the city, they work here, work for the government, or for, you know, law firms, or for, you know, anybody else. They go home. The district is the only place that can't tax in the United States, possibly one of the only places in the world, that does not have the right to tax income where it's earned.
Mm-hmm.
All that income goes back home to Maryland and Virginia. And so, the city has to provide all the services of roads and buildings and things like that, but they can't tax a lot of the income that's earned here. So there's a significant economic impact. It's estimated at over $1 billion a year, which is a pretty significant piece of what it takes to run the city. So that's one of the costs.
Right, and then, of course, the city has to service all those people who live somewhere else and then drive in to go to work here.
That's right.
So we're paying the bill, but we can't tax them for those services that are being provided. So, well, what about that point from the Founding Fathers? It says the nation's capital should be on neutral ground. What if we were our own state or belong to another state? Couldn't that be a problem too? Or why don't you think that argument is faulty?
Well, what's interesting is that we are the only capital city in the world where the residents of the capital are not given voting representation in their Congress or in their elected body. So, of any of the democracies.
Are you serious? We're the only one in the world?
Yeah, no. There were a few countries that adopted the U.S. Constitution pretty much in whole. Brazil was one at one point. Australia was another. And they quickly realized that it didn't make sense to disenfranchise the people living in the capital city, that there's no reason for it, really. And so they changed it. But we have maintained that status under our Constitution. And so we're the only ones who still can't vote in, we don't have that most basic of the precepts of American democracy, is that you have the right to elect the people who write the laws that you live under. As you said, that's what the American Revolution was all about. That's what we, 200 years later, still don't have.
Yeah, so I guess if all the other countries in the world have figured out how to have capital residents enfranchised, you would think we, as the leader of modern democracy, would be able to figure that out too.
Yeah, no, we could certainly do it, if there was any political will to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a hard thing, is that, it's not the only people whose interests it's really directly involved are the very people who don't have any power to make that change. So while there are a lot of people in Congress who, are concerned and talk about the how terrible the situation is, it's nobody's primary business. It's nobody's going to spend, a lot of political capital for something that doesn't really involve their citizens that they represent.
Right. Well, this is fascinating. So D.C. is not a state. It's not a territory like Puerto Rico. So kind of what is it exactly?
Well, it's a unique jurisdiction, and what differentiates us from Puerto Rico, for example, is they don't pay federal taxes. I don't believe they're also eligible for a draft. Residents mm-hmm. of the district have, you know, are drafted whenever there is a draft. And to be clear, we have volunteered way above our proportion in the country for war. In fact, in all of our wars, people from the district have gone to war, have died for the country, and more people have died from the residents of the district than a number of states. And I think in World War II, it was, or in the Vietnam War, I believe it was more than 10 other states. And even though our population was probably only larger than perhaps one state at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we feel like we fulfill all the duties of American citizenship. We pay taxes, we're eligible for the draft, and yet we don't have that most basic American right.
That's amazing. And Washington, D.C. is pretty populated. I don't know what it is currently. I think it's like 600,000 people or something, but we have more residents in D.C. than some states do, right?
That's right. We passed Vermont and Wyoming, or we passed Wyoming. I believe we passed Vermont, and a couple of other states are also around a million or a little bit less. So, you know, it's not the one of the arguments that's used as to why we shouldn't have representation or why we shouldn't be a state, because statehood is obviously one of the ways to resolve this problem, is that we're too small. But, you know, we are larger than a couple of states. We're around the same size as three or four or five others. So that argument doesn't really hold water.
Yeah. That, by the way, was the winning argument I used, just a little aside here, when I was elected governor of Red Sox Nation for Washington, D.C. Originally, they wanted to call me a mayor and then have each of the other 50 state representatives were called governors, because they were governors of states, and I would then be the mayor of the District of Columbia. And I fought the Red Sox about it, and I said, well, hey, you know, we here in D.C., we pay our taxes, we get drafted, we fight and die for our country. We should be a state. There's a movement for us to become a state. And just because we've been disenfranchised here as full-fledged citizens doesn't mean that the Red Sox should be on the wrong side of history here, and the Red Sox should not be party to, you know, the disenfranchise of American citizens. And by the way, we have more residents in D.C. than in some other states, including Vermont. And they actually took it and had a discussion among the Red Sox board there, and they decided to change my title from mayor to governor. So at least in one part of America, we're kind of considered at equal status of statehood.
Well, from the Red Sox to the U.S. Congress, that's what I think.
Exactly. So, addressing this question of self-governance, so without the ability to vote for our members of the House or the Senate, and this that's at the federal Congress, there was also the lack of ability for self-governance kind of in a more immediate sense as a city or so Congress has been governing D.C. directly since the founding of our country, is that right? Until you talked about the mayor, we got that right in the 1970s. But up until then, was Congress governing D.C. directly?
Well, they've usually appointed some number of overseers of one type or another, often delegating some of that power to the president to appoint individuals to act as a de facto mayor or as a de facto city council.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 19th century, it was usually these were all appointed positions. Wasn't elected until, as I said, you know, much more recently. But even now, and it's from the beginning, the words of the Constitution haven't changed. The U.S. Congress has total plenary, meaning full, complete authority over anything that happens in the district. And so even though we now have our own city council that, you know, elects the laws of the district, the Congress always has the right to step in and overturn any of those laws at any time that it wants. Now, granted, it's only done that a couple of times in the last 30, 40 years. that power is still always there. The fact they've only done it a couple of times shows that it's sort of, that there's no reason for it at this point. We're a grown-up, very large city, one of the largest, 10 largest cities in the country. We're growing rapidly. It's a really fabulous city. I mean, if you haven't been to Washington, it's a great place. And I think it's time for us to be full and equal citizens.
Yeah, absolutely. And there has been some progress, though slow and limited over the centuries here now. But in 1961, D.C. residents got the right to vote in presidential elections. How did that happen?
That was interesting. Yes, we had didn't have a right to vote for the president. I want to be clear that there's always been organizing by people in the city, for full representation. Even, the city was officially started in 1800, and on day one, some city fathers, went to the town hall and protested and said, "There's no reason for this." So, this runs counter to the precepts of American democracy. So we've been fighting this every day, for hundreds of years. I'm sorry, where was the question?
About how did we get the right to vote in presidential elections?
So in the at the height of the Cold War, I think there was some concern that the Soviets would use the example of Washington as an example of where American democracy was not so great, and to show that we were hypocritical. And that they would, say, "How can you, you're denied, you complain about us, and you deny your own residents the right to vote." And that argument, in the Cold War was kind of serious, and there was constant competition with the Russians. And a constitutional amendment was put forward, and it flew through the Congress, and it had to be ratified by 75% of the states, and that was done extremely quickly, and there was no real argument. And so it was passed in 1961. So 1964 was the first time that the residents could actually vote for the president. Now, we were limited in the Constitution. The constitutional amendment limited us to the number of electoral votes as the smallest state. At that time, our population was actually even larger than it is now, and we were larger than quite a few states, and would have been eligible for, I think, two congressional districts, House seats, which would have added up to 4 electoral votes in the Electoral College. But we were limited to being no larger than the smallest other state. So even when they gave us something, they took something away. But that was our first real victory in terms of having voting rights.
Wow. Too bad we couldn't have kind of jammed the whole thing through right then, right? Not only the right to vote for president, but the right to vote for someone to represent us in the House and the Senate. But I guess, you just at least start with something is better than nothing.
Well, that's, that's always the progressive question is, do you take the half a loaf? Do you take, the incremental victory and build from there? Or are you better off holding out for the whole ball of wax?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, 53 years later, I'm not so sure that was the right decision, but.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll see.
Well, then in 1973, Congress gave D.C. home rule of a sort. So tell us what home rule means, and what does D.C. do now for self-governance, and what control does Congress still retain?
So we have a 13-member city council. We have a mayor, and they pretty much run, everything about the government that any normal city would do. It also has fulfilled state responsibilities in terms of state boards of education and administering federal programs to the states, such as Medicare. We do everything the normal state does. We do everything that a normal city does also, which does result in a pretty big government, a lot of people working for the public sector. But the Congress, again, retains the power to overturn anything we do. And one of the ways that they have exerted that power numerous times and almost continually is on the D.C. budget. And the D.C. budget it gets approved locally, but then it has to go to Congress for approval. And when it's up there, on Capitol Hill, this is where they put on so-called social riders on our budget that have prevented us from doing a few things. And those, most importantly, are they prevent us from using our own local dollars. These are not federal tax dollars, but these are tax dollars paid by district residents to the D.C. government. We can't spend those without government, federal government okay. The Congress has said you can't spend those on Medicaid abortions. You can't fund those, even with your own dollars. They've also, at times, tried to interfere in our right to regulate guns in the district. They've overturned an initiative process from a number of years ago on marijuana. And really, terribly important is that they prevented us from having a needle exchange program. And the district had a terrible AIDS crisis.
It was the worst in the country for a while. It had the highest rates of AIDS percentage in the country.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, unfortunately, it's true that you know, you can say that people die in the District of Columbia because we don't have voting rights.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we had a representative in the Senate in particular, where it's really, you know, a really powerful position, we do have a non-voting delegate in the House. But if we had a full voting delegate, who was a full House member, and if we had someone in the Senate, you wouldn't have these types of social riders. The Congress, even if it retained authority over the district, they just wouldn't exert it at all. That's just the way that the institution works up there. Nobody would mess with anybody else's city or state. But because we've been prevented from having a needle exchange program in the city with the highest rate of HIV AIDS in the country, you know, mm-hmm. needle exchange programs are just known to work. There's no real question about that. You know, we have run a program not quite as large as we'd like, and it's been done with private dollars and foundation dollars, but it was not run by the government, and it was not as robust as it might have been.
Yeah, those needle programs, I mean, they're proven successful public health strategies.
So it's really awful that we were prevented from you know, using our own tax dollars again for things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we lose out, you know, on those types of social riders. The other costs of federal control, as we talked about earlier, the commuter taxes that we're not allowed to impose. The district just in general, you know, loses out because it's the federal seat of government. There are enormous numbers of government offices that take up a huge percentage of our business downtown. Those are not taxed. You can't the embassies for all the foreign countries that are here, they don't pay property taxes. And all the nonprofits, I mean, and we mean thousands and thousands of nonprofit organizations that are here in the city, they don't pay, you know, property taxes when they own their own buildings. And believe me, they own some of the nicest buildings in downtown Washington.
Mm-hmm. And then we very recently, just this past year, had an experience where the residents of D.C. voted overwhelmingly to legalize small amounts of marijuana. But now Congress wants to overturn that decision. Tell us about what's happening there.
Well, so the citizens did overwhelmingly vote to legalize marijuana. That was in the November election. Our laws, when we pass them, we still have to submit them to Congress for it's a waiting period. The Congress has this period where it can act it can actually act anytime it wants, but there's a formal waiting period also. And I'm not sure. I think we may have just submitted the referendum that passed to Congress for approval. And there's a question as to whether or not they, you know, what they will do. They've got 30 legislative days, which takes about 70 to 80 calendar days to actually get through, and they may or may not choose to act on that. There's also questions as to whether or not we can just go ahead and consider the law to be enacted, and if Congress chooses to overturn it, they can overturn it. So right now, if people want to light up in Washington, I'm not quite sure what where they stand. It's a little bit of a legal limbo right now. We on the voting rights side, we think that the city has the power to enact the law. It's been enacted and it's self-executing. And it exists, and if Congress wants to overturn it, they can go ahead and do that. But we'll see what happens. I'm sure this will be called into question in the near future.
So practically speaking, if Congress wants to overturn what the residents of D.C. voted for, is that a majority vote in the House, or does it have to be passed by the House and the Senate both?
It would actually have to be, to overturn it, it would be a bill, and it would have to be attached to a bill or a separate bill. So it would have to go through the House, the Senate, and the President would have to sign it.
Wow. Well, that works in our favor because they're so dysfunctional over there, it's hard to get too much passed.
That's right. But what's happened in the past is they'll try and attach the bill to a piece of legislation that has to pass. And that's been, you know, the federal budget, the debt ceiling a few years ago when we've been fighting to you have to raise the debt ceiling every so often. They've used those opportunities to attach, you know, legislation about the district that really is so picayune. I mean, it's just, you know, it's rather embarrassing that, you know, at times the entire federal government's opening or closing has depended on, you know, whether or not the district is given the right to control its own, you know, needle exchange or can fund Medicaid abortions.
Right. And you mentioned in passing that a D.C. government is both the city government and the state government, kind of the equivalent of it. So we have some significant number of government workers. And I just wanted to do a little hats off here to Marion Barry, who had been elected in the 1970s when D.C. finally got the ability to elect their own mayor here, and served as mayor for many years and then on the city council for decades longer. And one of the things he did was, and then, you know, he just passed away about a month ago, I think. And but one of the things Marion Barry did as mayor in D.C. was to make sure that when contracts from the D.C. government were given out, that at the time there was kind of a small group of whites that controlled that money, even though the city was overwhelmingly black. And Marion Barry made sure that the government contracts from D.C. would be spread out more widely. And that decision and the work he did with the government here really helped to create a stronger black middle class for D.C. So just a little hats off to Marion Barry there.
Yeah, he did a great job of doing that. I mean, he truly did create a black middle class here that's you know, really almost unparalleled. And it was through his own force of personality, and he was just very clear that he was going to make the government work for the people of Washington. And he was very effective at that. Another way he did that was by, you know, he expanded the number of people who worked directly for the government. And those are good, solid, you know, jobs with, you know, long-term job security. And he made sure that we had enough people to run the government, and it was just a very effective policy.
Right. Very good. So back to the story of the District of Columbia here, you know, there are these kind of little snippets along the way where some progress was made, but in 1978, there was a serious initiative where Congress took the first step to pass a constitutional amendment by passing legislation for voting representation, passed in both the U.S. House and Senate. But then it had to be ratified by 38 states to actually become a constitutional amendment. So what happened with that initiative?
Well, that's a really, you know, interesting story, also from the progressive angle of, you know, what do you take and when do you take it? After the civil rights movement had achieved, you know, many of its objectives with the you know, Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of 64-65, you know, people's attention did turn to Washington as, you know, an overwhelmingly majority African American city, as a place that, you know, was, you know, there was a lot to achieve here and that could be achieved that wasn't. And there was a strong statehood movement in the late 60s and early 70s. And a lot of people thought this was going to be the next big battle of the civil rights movement. And by the time, you know, when you're into the late 70s, you know, there was a strong statehood movement here. And some people suggest that this constitutional amendment was put forward almost as a if you call that a red herring, something to chase after that wasn't ever going to be achieved. Because we had never created a state by constitutional amendment. And let me just take one step back. There are several different ways that the district could gain full voting representation. You know, one is just through becoming a state, going through the statehood process. Another is through this constitutional amendment process that wasn't going to create statehood, but it was going to give us full voting rights, so at least voting representation, something short of statehood, but with federal representation on the Hill. So that some people think that that constitutional amendment process was sort of doomed to failure from the beginning, because a constitutional amendment, as you said, requires two-thirds of the House, two-thirds of the Senate, signature of the president to go ahead, and then it needs to pass the state legislatures. Three-quarters of the state legislatures have to pass it. Well, there's a case of political interest. It's not really in any state's interest to have more states coming into the union. It sort of dilutes their power, because you add two more senators to the Senate, and every two that you add dilutes your own senator's power. So as we sometimes say, if statehood required a constitutional amendment, we'd still have 13 states, because nobody ever would have ratified an amendment to provide more to increase the number. So we did get this constitutional amendment passed through the House and the Senate. I believe it was signed, has to be signed by the president. But it died in the process of trying to get three-quarters of the states. In fact, after 7 years, there's a seven-year limit on a constitutional amendment to achieve the number of state legislature approvals that you need. And at the end of 7 years, we only had 16. And, you know, it just shows that it was not a battle that was possibly winnable. But it took away it took the wind out of the sails of the statehood movement for quite a while, because people were working on this constitutional amendment, and it was hard to say to Congress, no, you should do something else for us, when, you know, they could say, well, look, we passed the amendment, you know, you go work on it, you get that passed.
Mm. Very interesting. It's a shame that that didn't go through then. You know, you do hope that the different states would have ratified it just on the basic American principle of no taxation without representation. And it's such an American principle to stand on that we should elect the people who make the decisions about governing us. But apparently that wasn't enough in 1978 to get that done.
And I'm not sure when that's ever been enough. You know, for every time you want to get something passed, you have to have some reason to get senators and representatives to vote for it. And as you say, it's often about self-interest. It's about interest for something that's for their own constituents.
Mm-hmm.
And just doing the right thing, that doesn't always carry the day. And it certainly didn't carry the day for the constitutional amendment for voting rights for the city.
How has it happened? You know, you mentioned we started with our 13 states. We now have 50. What is the process for a territory to become a state? Because we have expanded from our 13 original colonies and 13 original states, and now we've got 50 states, so 37 times we've added in new states. So how does that process happen?
Well, as you say, the tradition, there are several different methods, but the main one that's occurred, I think, for the last 20 or 30 states that have come in is they've almost all come in as a territory under territory government. They create a shadow government a shadow set of representatives who come to Washington and act as a shadow delegation, so almost like practice senators and congressmen. The federal government has control over the territory. It can tax them, so it is possible to be taxed and not have full representation, because there's a history of these territories being taxed before they were given statehood. And so that's the process, and that's a process that statehood advocates for in the district foresee for the city.
Mm-hmm.
Right now we're this odd animal. We're not a territory, but we have been a territory. We've been considered to be a territory before. In fact, that was taken away from us at some point. So it's quite possible to see us returning to territory status and applying for statehood and trying to get that passed in Congress is a simple bill that only requires a majority of the House and the Senate and a signature by the president to become law.
Yeah, so you think we could go that route even, you know, despite what the Constitution says about, and I actually haven't read it. Do you know by offhand what article that is in the Constitution?
Article, I think it's Article 1, Section 8. Clause 17, I believe. I'll get that for you in a minute.
Yeah.
But that would be so the process that the city would undergo is, you're right, the Constitution requires that there be a federal city. So what we would do is almost all the federal buildings, it's kind of fortunate, are all right in this core, the center of the city with the House, with the Capitol and the White House, the monuments, what we call the monumental core of the city. And that includes the House office buildings and Senate office buildings and federal buildings, you know, for Department of Agriculture and IRS and Commerce, all of that. You can pretty much draw a line around all of those buildings and not include a single resident, except for the president. The president would be like the one oddball situation, but you can pretty much exclude all of the people from the District of Columbia and keep that federal core, that federal city, capital of the United States, Washington, D.C. The Constitution says that the capital city shall be no larger than 10 miles on each side, a 10-mile square.
But it could be smaller.
It can get smaller, and it doesn't say how small it can get. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we think we can do. In fact, in the 1840s, the southern part of our diamond, that was the land that came from Virginia, retroceded and went back to Virginia. So we're smaller than we were originally. We're no longer 10 miles on a side. We're only, instead of being 100 square miles, we're about 68 square miles. So we can get smaller, and we think that we could get radically smaller if we wanted it to. So we would shrink the city down to that federal core, and then the remaining land where the 660,000 residents of the district live would become a territory and would then apply for statehood and would then go through the normal statehood process that we've done, you know, 37 times.
Yeah, so I see what you're saying. So the idea is you shrink what the official U.S. capital territory is,
right,
down to, you know, Congress and then some, you know, you mentioned all the monuments and things that we've got. So you could actually draw a line around the Capitol and a lot of the museums and different monuments there are around the city, and then you could say, okay, we're changing the contours of the Capitol to include the U.S. Congress and in these other areas, and have that be really small, and then you take the land outside of that, which is where most of the residents of D.C. live, and declare that a territory and then turn that into a state. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly the process. And, you know, then you apply for it to become a state. If it passes, the bill passes. You know, you got your two senators. Right now would be one member of the House, and we're good to go. And we're like every other American citizen at that point. It's actually the simplest process. It's very straightforward, and like I said, we've done it 37 times. So there's no mystery around it. There's no real constitutional question. We don't think there'd be any real way to challenge that in the courts. I think there's almost no question that the Congress has the power to do that.
I love that. Why don't we just do that?
Well, we should. You know, and that we've been working on that for a long time. But what your question is, you know, where's the political will and why isn't there political will to do that? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that, unfortunately, for the last, you know, long period of time has been mired in, you know, we're a victim of Democrats versus Republicans. And, you know, them seeing this as a politics as a zero-sum game. And if they allow the district to become a state, well, it's pretty obvious which way the district's going to vote right now. It's overwhelmingly a Democratic city, and it almost certainly would elect Democratic representatives. So it's, you know, mostly been Republicans who have fought the idea of, you know, statehood or almost, you know, or anything that starts to move in that direction. Now, you know, there are historical anomalies when Alaska and Hawaii came in. they came in particularly, and this has happened since the Civil before the Civil War, where they've paired states. They've brought in two states in short order, one more conservative, one more liberal, and to sort of maintain the balance of power in Congress. When Alaska and Hawaii came in 1959, Alaska came in as a Democratic state and Hawaii came in as the Republican state. And everybody thought that's how it would remain. But today, they've absolutely reversed, and Alaska is pretty much a reliably Republican state, and Hawaii pretty much is a blue state.
Mm-hmm. But that's amazing.
But there's no, you know, it's not a serious argument to say that the district isn't going to be Democratic for, you know, the foreseeable future. And unfortunately for a lot of people, that's more important than, you know, the basic rights of democracy, which we think really should trump that.
Yeah. Well, we have those very narrow windows sometimes where the Democrats control the House and the Senate and the White House, where conceivably this strategy could have passed at that time, but those
why didn't it
exactly when the chance was there? I guess it's just always some other priority.
Well, some other priority, and you know, the last time that the Democrats had control of the House and the Senate and the presidency, you know, the city, well, you know, there's a lot of cities in the 90s went through a very tough economic time, and we in fact had a control board that was put in place to control the spending of the city and to get us back into the black. We were running a deficit. There've been a lot of, you know, we've had a lot of economic problems, and some of those are tied to the federal control, and as I said, the lack of being able to tax income earned here that goes away, and the special costs of being the capital city. There have been lots of reasons for it, but the truth is that we've run deficits at some times, and that's been used against us as why we shouldn't be a state. You know, we've also been said we shouldn't be a state because we don't have any farms, you know, and we're too urban. Teddy Kennedy called it the two twos. He said we're too urban, we're too black, we're too Democratic, and we're too progressive. You know, some of those things are true. Some of those are important. Some of those aren't really important, shouldn't really be an issue. One of those was that, you know, we don't have any rural areas. You know, we're a city. But I'm not sure that that's really a solid argument against us.
Yeah, that's a very interesting analysis by Senator Kennedy there. Too urban, too black, and too progressive. I was wondering about that. You know, the city was very black and very high percentage for a very long time. It's now kind of less so as the city has grown, and it's become a very kind of hip and chic and interesting place. Lots of people in their 20s and 30s moving here. It's a foodie destination with all the great restaurants. So it's really kind of changed in complexion in many ways. But what role do you think racism plays in blocking statehood for D.C.?
Oh, I think there's no question that that was probably the major. Don't want to ascribe, you know, racist reasons to people's actions without knowing more specifically, but the truth is it was partly that we were too Democratic, and it was partly that we were too black. That, you know, I believe we were not considered seriously for statehood earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Even when the Democrats could have theoretically pushed a bill through.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's really any question that, you know, and it wasn't always, you know, it's not always Republicans. You know, you can go back to the Southern Democrats who really controlled the district in the, you know, 20s, 30s, in the 40s, 50s, early 60s. They're the ones who controlled the city. It was, and they were terrible to the city, many of them. Many were just, you know, said, we're just not going to, you know, put money into, and they controlled the purse strings, we're not going to put money into the blacks into schools. We're not going to, you know, fund blacks. They used a different word. On the floor of the House. I mean, they're just terrible quotes from, you know, people who are, you know, our representatives around the country, and the way that they treated the city. I mean, it was really a stain on American democracy.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting hearing you talk. I'm actually getting more hopeful about it in the sense that there may be some combination of increasing awareness and justice around race relations. Not that we're all the way there, but it's certainly way better now than it was 50 years ago. So as that kind of race relations improvement happens, and combining that with change demography within the city, where it is, it's a lot more non-black, shall we say, a lot more whites, I don't know about the Asians, but it's not such a heavily black area anymore. So maybe the intersection of those two trends could be hopeful that at some point that D.C. could become a state.
Yeah, well, we certainly hope it's not based on those type of racial changes, that's what it takes to get to American democracy. That's certainly not how it should be.
Right.
But the reality is that the city is much more balanced racially than it has been in the past. And, we certainly fight with the issues of gentrification and the city has just become very expensive. It's as you said, it's a very hot destination. It's real estate prices go up. Poor people are being forced out of, what were those really rough urban communities are now being brew pubs everywhere and cafes. It really is true. It's just a very different city than it used to be. And
yeah,
it's forcing a lot of people out who have been here for generations and have some rights to, I think personally should have some rights to stay where they've lived. But, it's a very, very tough issue. How it'll play out in politics, we'll see. We'll see if it's, how much a change in racial complexion makes. We're still going to vote Democratic, and my guess is that's still going to be an issue on the politics side.
Yeah. Well, and what about this other option? You had laid out the three different pathways for D.C. to get voting representation in Congress, and one of them was becoming part of a state. You mentioned that originally it was Maryland and Virginia kind of donated the land to the federal government to make the capital, and that the Virginia side of D.C., decided that it wanted to go back to become part of Virginia. Of course, the Potomac River separates the two states there, but that the Virginia side of D.C. decided to revert back to become part of Virginia again. So that all happened. So they're now back with Virginia. But what about taking some chunk of the land that's currently in the District of Columbia and reverting that back to Maryland, so then we become part of Maryland and we get our two state senators from there? That also avoids the problem of the Republicans complaining that we'll get two more Democratic senators there because there would be no additional senators that way.
Well, that's certainly another possibility, and that's the other main route, short of a constitutional amendment. Yes, it would be the same idea as statehood, where you'd probably retain the federal core as the capital of the country, and the rest of the landmass with all the people could retrocede back into Maryland, just as Arlington County, that included the city of Alexandria, retroceded back to Maryland in the 1840s before the Civil War. So that could happen. It would require the approval of the residents of the district. It would also require the approval of the residents of Maryland, and I believe it would. I believe it also requires the approval of the legislatures on both sides.
But that wouldn't require a constitutional amendment, would it?
We don't think so. We don't think so because it didn't require a constitutional amendment when Virginia retroceded. So, again, there is a model, and it is possible. Problem is, it just, I have very close friends who really, believe that this is the solution, the most elegant solution. It would be nice, I can make an argument for why it would be nice to be part of Maryland and have those two senators right away and to have you know, the support of a state. And I mean, it is helpful to cities to have the support of a state and have, you know, a bigger tax base. And it deals with some of those regional issues of, you know, people live in one part of the, in the city in a state, but they go home to a county. Well, at least those taxes can be paid to a state government that can redistribute them in a way that helps, you know, the entire region. You know, you can make a strong argument as to why that might make sense. They're on the other side. People, you know, feel like they're Washingtonians, and they, you know, feel like they don't want to be part of, many people don't want to be part of Maryland. They don't want to be, they see themselves as a Washingtonian. Now, my friends say, look, do people in Baltimore, do they feel any less part of Baltimore because they're in the state of Maryland?
Right.
You know?
So, exactly.
You know, I think it's, you can make the argument on both sides. Is there political will to make retrocession happen? Is this to the benefit of both the district and Maryland? And particularly, you have to think about, why would Maryland do it? You know, would they want to incorporate, you know, 660,000 mm-hmm. people? I can think of some groups in Maryland that might not be happy to, you know, incorporate 660,000, you know, new residents. You know, the
yeah.
Republicans, for one, in Maryland, it's already a Democratic state. You bring in a population that's, you know, 65% tilted Democrat, you know, it's going to make it even harder for them to get elected. So I think that's an immediate stumbling block.
Yeah.
You know, there are lots of people whose oxes would get gored if, you know, if they took all of Washington in. That said, it is a solution. It does have a lot to speak for. It is easy. It's relatively easy to do. We think that it's been done before. We think we could follow that path. But I just don't see the political will to do it.
So to have any of these three paths followed for D.C. to get voting representation in Congress, it will require, you know, strategy, action, mobilization. Is that why you started D.C. Vote?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we recognized that there needed to be a center for the organizing. People, as I said, people have been organizing for representation for the district from day one in 1800. And it's been episodic, and it's been fairly consistent. You know, it comes up every 10 or 20 years. There's some other movement. There, you know, a lot of ideas get recycled. But nobody, to my knowledge, except for a very, you know, brief window of a year or two during the state, during the constitutional amendment process in the 70s, no one's been paid to, you know, work on this issue day in, day out. And, you know, one thing you learn from organizing is you need to have people working the issue all the time, every day. When they get up in the morning, that's the one thing that they think about, is how are we going to get this done? Because, you know, nothing's easy, right? Nothing gets done. No political change just occurs. And, you know, we started around a lawsuit that was going on at the time, and a bunch of friends got together and said, how can we support the lawsuit? And who's doing the political organizing? Who's doing the press releases and getting people out in the street? And, you know, the lawyer said, hey, we're not doing that, you know, but you should do that. So we started doing it as lots of volunteers, and after a year or two, we had enough people together and enough interest that we thought we could create an organization. So we founded DC Vote in 1998 to act as an umbrella for anybody who wanted to achieve voting representation or statehood and statehood for the district. And that's what we've tried to do, and tried to create a home where, you know, skills and resources could be developed and preserved and keep fighting, because you're going to get the opportunities. Things are going to happen. Congress is going to do something stupid. You can just sort of count on it. Every, you know, year or two, they're going to do something that you're going to want to get out there and get it in the streets and make noise about and mm-hmm. use as a lever to achieve the goal. But you got to be there. You got to be ready for it to take advantage of it. And so that was the purpose for creating the organization.
Excellent. Good for you. Our very own human rights and democracy group here in D.C., what progress would you say you've made in the 16 years since you founded D.C. Vote?
Well, I think the debate is completely different now than it was, and that's partly responsible. You know, we're partly responsible, but partly it's just the change of the times and, you know, the better economic climate and the city being much bigger and stronger. We're just taken much more seriously. You know, we don't have the economic problems we had at one time. We've got something like $1.7 billion, you know, in the bank in the city of surpluses. You know, there are not many cities in the country, and all of any city in the country can claim that. We're a big, strong, real, competent place, and there, you know, that helps make the case for why we deserve all of the fruits of American democracy, as we said, having already always paid all of the prices and fulfilling all the obligations. So things are just different. For example, there was a statehood hearing. There was a hearing on a statehood bill in the U.S. Senate last year. Now, it wasn't going to pass. I mean, there, you know, we were under no illusions that we were going to get that bill passed last year. But you couldn't talk about statehood really seriously, you know, 10 years ago when we were under receivership, or 15 years ago when we were under receivership. Today, it's a different world. We had this hearing on the Hill. Alice Rivlin, who's a economic scholar in the district, testified in support. Viet Dinh, who's a conservative constitutional scholar. Legal for us to do this. There was no constitutional bar, and you know, the sky didn't fall. We could talk about statehood in a serious manner.
Mm-hmm.
I think the issue is moving forward, and whether it's statehood or some other way path to voting rights, you can talk about this stuff now. And
yeah.
I think it's now become, when is it going to happen? Not if. We're going to get there. I just hope we can get there, you know, in my lifetime, you know.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, I'm thinking about the success that was had back in 1961, getting the right to vote for president, by the embarrassment that the lack of democracy in our nation's capital was worldwide. What about appealing to the United Nations and bringing some international pressure? Have you pursued that course at all?
There are some people who have absolutely pursued that course, and have brought a case before, I believe, the OAS, Organization of American States. And we've also dealt with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Europe,
mm-hmm.
And have tried to use those forums. They don't have direct authority over the U.S., and you know, I think the Congress has chafed against international pressure before, and probably would again. But they're definitely good routes. They're good ways to get the word out and to get people excited.
And just very briefly, we've got 30 seconds left. What can listeners do to help the people in D.C. get our full rights as citizens?
Well, they're the folks who have rights themselves and can influence the people who control the district's destiny. So I hope you'd go to dcvote.org, sign up, become a member, and just so that we can contact you when we have a vote, when we need you to put pressure on your representatives, or just educate them anytime, and educate your neighbors and your friends. Let them know. Don't be part of the 50% of America that thinks we have representation when we don't really. We need to get there, and we need your support to help make that happen.
Fabulous. That's all the time we have. Daniel Solomon, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for coming on the program.
No, thanks. Hope we can do it again sometime.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Many thanks to our research associate, Dr. Judith Singleton. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now. Not everyone knows.